This is Gregory Donovan, and we're interviewing today Marjorie Agosin, who is here to give a lecture at Virginia Commonwealth University, sponsored by the School of World Studies. It's a series of lectures called Crossing Boundaries. I'm here today with Jeff Lodge, and we are going to be asking her a number of questions related to the subject of her lecture this evening, which is poetry and human rights, but also about her life as a writer and her peculiar personal and family history. The first thing I wanted to say to you is to apologize for not being able to conduct this entire interview in Spanish, but
I forgive you.
Thank you. But nevertheless, our readers are probably going to expect to encounter you in English. And I thought I might start by mentioning that I have sometimes described Robert Lowell to my students as a poet who was a moral historian of our country. And that role was not so much a choice of his as it was a matter of unavoidable circumstance, something that was thrust on him because he was born a Lowell in a family that included presidents of Harvard and governors of Massachusetts and astronomers of Mars. You know, it was Percival Lowell who came up with that idea there were canals on Mars. Your own family history has similarly, it seems to me, thrust you into the circumstance of having to bear certain responsibilities, and you are yourself a moral historian, in particular because you carry in your family such a troubled history, and it's the history of our century, it's also the history of your own family, including such figures as your great-grandmother, Helena Broder, in The Angel of Memory. I wondered if you could talk about a sense of responsibility, opportunity, how you feel about having that burden placed on you.
Well, it's very interesting and flattering to be called a moral historian and to also think that Robert Lowell was. I think there are two things I'd like to talk about. I think that in all expressions of art, there's always the choice, the desire to do it, the almost an inner drive to do it, and also there's the history. So what I'm trying to say is that in spite of being a heir of a very turbulent history, which is really the history of the Jews in the 20th century, which is the history of not only genocide, but it's really the history of the diaspora, and on top of it, being in the midst of another historical revolution during the Allende years, which brought me back again to the United States, and I was the great-granddaughter, the granddaughter, and the daughter of immigrants, but then I became an immigrant myself. To go back to my initial thought is that even though I was thrust into this history, I made a conscious choice. So what I'm saying that it's not enough to be part of that history. You must make the choice that you will speak for this history. And in that choice, I think that there is an element of vulnerability, courage, but individual commitment. I think that too many people are thrown into history but remain accomplices, which means are silent. I think what I like to say, and this is something I am the most proud of, that I made the choice to become a witness of those times. I made an absolutely conscious choice that I was going to be that. And I continue to look at the world with the same passion and commitment for social justice as when I was 17 years old. And sometimes people cannot believe it. They think I'm this crazy idealist, but I am the same, even more now. But I want to say it's choice and then history.
In your approaches to writing poetry, memoir, or fiction, what differences do you sense in yourself, spiritually or conceptually or even technically, as you go to those different genres? Do you put on different selves? Do you approach them in a different way? Do they make different demands on you? Do you feel like you're a different person?
Well, I'm going to answer you because we are all of us artists, and as an artist, I think that it's the same self, which is the poet speaking. I mean, when some people say, oh, I read your poetry, but they're really referring to a memoir like A Cross and a Star or Always from Somewhere Else. My whole view of the world and my sense of language and understanding, it's informed by my understanding of poetic language. So I am a poet writing memoirs. I'm not a memorialist making poetry out of memoir. No, it's the poet that informs, describes, feels, and understands. So it's really the same self. And I would even go farther that even with essays, which there's a demand of historical truth, of more linear narrative, I still think I am the poet self speaking.
Is that a self that you think of as being something primarily attitudinal rather than something technical?
Yes and no. It is the attitudinal, but the technical is interesting because if you look at, and this may be not particularly to my own writing, but for many post-modern writers, especially Latin American writers, even the technicality of the fiction and the memoir resembles the forms of poetry. They're almost collages, images. They don't obey particularly to chronology, linear time. They're almost streamers of light thrown in the page.
You mentioned that word collage, and it seemed to me that that is place where the technical meets the personal in your own work, because you're a person with a hybrid cultural and geographical background, and it struck me as not so strange at all that you might be attracted to the quick transitions and juxtapositions mm-hmm. of opposing forces that mm-hmm. we associate with collage.
Yes, and I think that all the memoirs are written in the form of collage, all of them. And my most recent book is called Cartographies, Meditations on Travel, but a lot of people have trouble figuring out what it is and how do you categorize the kind of writing one does. I think the problem with readers is that they don't read enough poetry, because Cartographies is a poetical autobiography about place, but it is a poem. So going back to the idea of collages, I think collages responds to the evanescence of memory and of the sense of belonging. I've always struggled to retain what I have lost, and I've tried to retain it through writing, but then I realized that not even writing can hold to this tremendous loss, and that's why it's so fragmented.
It's interesting that you say that. That particular metaphor as well, that is one that you use often in your writing, and it puts me in mind of a friend of Robert Lowell's, Elizabeth Bishop, who was an exiled poet who was from the United States but lived much of her adult life in Brazil. And you know, she wrote books called North and South, Questions of Travel, Geography 3, and she used that notion of the metaphor of map making, of cartography and geography. Mm-hmm. Also, it was an extended metaphor that included the idea that she was a woman looking for her place in the universe, you know, in the world.
Yes. I love Elizabeth Bishop, and I think that in Latin America she's really well known. I think she's much more well known than Lowell, I think because of her experience in Brazil. Women and women artists are looking at a place to belong in the world and to call home in a very particular way. I think that women are looking for a place that will allow them to be visible. I think we live in very conflicted gender times, and most of it is the possibility for visibility. Visibility as creators, visibility in the home. If you look at the whole scope of the human rights situation, you see how women are always hidden. Even the veil is a form of hiding. So I think that home is to become visible. And I think that Brazil allowed Elizabeth Bishop to be herself. And I think there are certain homes or countries that allow for people to be who they are.
Yes. That leads me to another question about your choice to write in Spanish. Well, there's two related questions here I'd like to ask you. You've written that the English language never took on the texture of my soul, and so you've continued in your commitment to writing in Spanish, and of course that therefore suggests that Spanish, the Spanish language, is a soul home for you, maybe a portable soul home. Do you feel interrupted or interfered with by having to live in a culture dominated by the English language? And of course, these days, that's not just America's, it's the whole world.
Yeah. Well, just like I said at your first question, that it was the choice to kind of become, and I feel this, it sounds very grandiose, but it's beautiful, to be like a moral historian of a time. I think that at first, when I arrived to the United States, I wasn't so sure whether I had made the choice to write in Spanish. But what I was so sure about was that I felt, and of course, this is not as dramatic as a refugee woman from Sudan or Iraq being displaced from everything, because I felt I came with my family and I had a privileged life. But I felt that to lose my language was to lose my soul, my being. And again, it's the image of being in a void. I think to be displaced is like in a void, almost like to think of T.S. Eliot, like the hollowness, a world of hollowness. So I knew that the only thing that I really had that was truly mine was language, was the Spanish language, in an almost unconscious way, because I was about 16 years old and I knew that that's the only thing that nobody could steal from me. Because I was even angry at my parents, because I felt that they cut me off from my country in the middle of my adolescence, and I loved my country. So I could never, maybe this was not a choice, somehow I could never write in English. I couldn't. Even, of course, I think I am a bilingual person, but the whole idea of taking on another language was as if I would have betrayed who I was. And then I read the beautiful writing of Milos when he says, especially his magnificent essays, that if he would not write in Polish, he wouldn't be who he is. And I think he kept his language as a way of keeping his Polish soul and his European soul and the World War II soul. And in a way, I feel that language evokes emotion, intimacy, affection. And the emotions I evoke in the Spanish language, in my writing, or even in my own life with other people, are not the same ones as in the English language. Also, the Latin culture, and we've talked with Eugenia about this, is a less guarded culture. And I feel that in this country there are too many, culturally, the whole concept of America, on the other, in one hand, is extremely free and open, but on the other hand, is very much into what is private, what cannot be said out loud. So the Spanish fitted everything I wanted to be, not only in terms of language, but in terms of culture. And the fact that everyone speaks English, I think that the fact that I live in an English-speaking world where I feel I don't fit, it's something that torments me. Even though I have lived here more than half of my life, I still feel, and even though I'm married to an English-speaking person and my children were born here, I feel that I don't belong. I feel like a stranger, which is very good for a poet, to feel like a stranger.
I had a second practical question following up on that. Do you prefer to translate your own work, or do you enjoy more having someone else translate? Is that like fun? And if you do have someone else translate, do you like to collaborate with them, or would you like to just say, surprise me?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never translated my own work. And I like to collaborate with people, and even though it's wonderful to say surprise me, but I really work with them very closely, and I've become fascinated with translation myself, because I've become to do some translations from the English to the Spanish. And I have learned the beauty and the humbleness and the delicacy that it takes to translate one poem from one language to the other. It's really a work of love, translation.
It's a very deep form of understanding,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So I work with the people that translate my work, and I've also been fortunate to have very close relationship with these people.
That seems important.
Back to the notion of not feeling at home in the U.S., I was wondering how it is for you living in the U.S. for so long now, knowing that these English-speaking people, that some of them anyway, were in a big way responsible, for example, for the overthrow of Allende, for much of the political and military brutality that's occurred in the 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. 80s, and I imagine mm-hmm. today in places.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was younger, I was kind of living through the history, talking about what happened, deeply aware of the U.S. role, the CIA, the Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon administrations. But I was more militant in my statements. Now I have a profound sadness to live here in a way, but I mean, I don't want to be ungrateful, because I'm extremely grateful for what I believe America is and for the possibilities America gave me. But my sadness is the complacency and the willingness to become so ignorant of the misfortunes of others. And before, as a younger person, it was anger. Now it's sorrow. And I, even though, you know, I teach at a very privileged school and have wonderful students, and in the outside, it could seem like a perfect life, it is very painful to live here. Not exactly because of your question, because of that history. But I also, what gives me hope are people like Peter Kornblau, who just did this huge book, The Pinochet Files. They're wonderful English-speaking Americans who have become the moral historians of this country. And to know that they exist, I feel less alone.